I'm going to talk to you about simulation mostly, and that's what's happening here on the screen. We have a simulation of the real world. It's very real. And what we see is that this animation that we have looks continuous, but actually it's done in discrete time intervals, finite time simulation. And also all of the components in here are represented to some resolution. They have some current state. The state vector for the system is the collection of state, such as the position of this box and its velocity and maybe its rotational angular momentum as it falls off the cliff there, and that sort of thing. So let's talk about some of those terms. So we're going to be talking about finite difference time domain simulations. And time domain means that we're modeling the time as it evolves. And it's going to be a finite quantized time in these simulations. And also where we're going to be simulating continuous things like rods or the atmosphere, then we're going to be simulating those in discretized form. We're going to split something that's continuous into an approximation of continuous by having a load of finite elements, and we'll have to choose how fine our element size should be. The sort of simulation that we'll be doing in this lecture is not event-driven simulation. Event-driven simulation is used very widely in simulating things such as computer circuitry, digital circuitry, or motor cars arriving at a junction, and queuing, and that sort of thing. So in event-driven simulation, we have a main data structure called the event queue, which has an ordered sequence of things to happen into the future. And each time something happens, then new consequences of that are inserted into that sorted event queue further on. But that's not what we're going to talk about. We're going to be talking about numeric simulations in this course. These are going to be over fixed or adaptive time domain steps. And we're going to be looking at just exchanging inter-element differences with our neighbours. So if I have an elemental component of my string or rod or atmosphere which is pressing on its neighbour with some force or exchanging some heat through its contact with its neighbour, then that's what we'll be simulating, the finite differences between the neighbours. A couple of more pieces of jargon on here. What's so funny?
You can hear the music from the game.
Ah, can you? All right. Well, I've put the sound on because I might want to play you something later on, but let's make the music a little bit quieter. So one of the pieces of jargon we're going to mention briefly is Monte Carlo simulation. Monte Carlo is where, in general, we're using random number generators in our simulation to simulate perhaps random starting points or also random events as the simulation progresses. Previously, we spoke about a Monte Carlo exploration of perturbations to see how stable a computation was, again, using random perturbations potentially. Now, there's another word here, ergodic, which is that we don't get stuck in a rut. If we were to simulate, for instance, a roulette table, and we do it as follows. We throw a ball at the start of the simulation, and the roulette wheel's going round and round and round, and then it goes into some slot at some point in the simulation, and then nothing else happens. The wheel gradually slows down, but nothing further. The ball doesn't change slot in a roulette wheel, it's stuck in its groove. And if we were now to take the average, if we were just to observe this simulation over time and look at which hole the ball was in, then we would see a rather biased distribution. We would see, in fact, that however long we simulate, it never moves anywhere else, And in fact, if we were taking the average, trying to work out whether this roulette wheel was fair or biased, then we would get very strongly the impression that it's biased, because we would be getting that, you know, 33 red is 100% likely and nothing else is likely at all. And that's because that's a non-ergodic simulation, getting stuck in that rut. And the way to simulate that sort of thing is actually to simulate from the start many times over, and then take what's called the ensemble average, which is the average over all those starting points. So simulating over starting points can be needed, but also it has the disadvantage that if there's a startup transient before the simulation becomes stable, then we'll be collecting statistics and going through that startup transient again and again. And so in general, it's better to simulate as much as possible in the time domain while the system is under some sort of equilibrium and randomly sample from that. And then perhaps we'll disregard the samples that we got at the very beginning of the simulation, but that's not always suitable. So that's just a little bit of jargon. Here's a Monte Carlo simulation. We're going to find the value of pi by throwing darts. And what we're going to do is we're going to assume we have a unit circle dartboard, throw a dart into a random rectangle. So we're going to uniformly distribute x and y in a square, so the surrounding square, not a rectangle. Well, a square is a special case of a rectangle, of course. But we're going to throw a dart into the surrounding square and see whether it's inside the circle as well. And if we simulate that, which we can do, with some rather simple code. What language is this one in today? It's in C-sharp today, which is rather the same as Java. It's very simple program as always. We're just going to take some random numbers and see whether it's inside or outside. Ah, here it is. If J0 times J0 plus J1 times J1 is less than V2, then we increment the insides. And so if we run that, what happens? Does it work? Yes. We run it three times. We've thrown a million darts in each one. And we have some estimate of pi. Pi seems to be changing in which decimal place. How accurate is our estimate? Seems to be changing in the fourth significant figure. So with a million throws, it looks like we got the answer correct to four significant figures. If you're a statistician, you can work that out and work out how accurate you really expect it to be and what the confidence limits are. And here's a plot of throwing for a different number of darts and looking at the mean and variance of the result. We can see the order of convergence here going down very slowly. That's a log left-hand axis, and it's a log right-hand axis. So it's a straight line on a log-log axis, which means it's a power law. And there's the mean and variance are following each other rather smoothly. There's a couple of other plots on there, which is for throwing antithetic darts, which is that for every random dart you throw, you can throw another one. And in antithetics theory, this is supposed to make you converge faster. But that's not on this syllabus. And I think in this simulation, it's actually producing a worse result. The A's results are above the straightforward results. So I've probably got the program wrong there, which is another reason why it's not on the syllabus. But it's a little bit of interesting theory if you're interested in how to reduce the effect of your random choices and get some faster convergence if you do it right. So the main topic I want to talk about is finite difference time domain simulations. And there are a number of systems that we can consider which roughly are equivalent when we come to simulate them. There's three which I'm going to loosely talk about for this first simulation. One is a heat conduction in a rod. The second is electrical conduction down a resistive line which has some capacitance. And the third one would be a water flow between a series of connected buckets. And we'll talk quite a lot about water flow in the next and final lecture. But some of you are probably very happy with resistors and capacitors. Others of you are perhaps happier with buckets and pipes. It's all going to be the same for this topic. So I've shown here in detail on this slide the equivalence between heat conduction in a rod and electrical conductance down a resistive wire with capacitance. So in both systems, we've taken a continuous structure, one-dimensional continuous structure, and we've partitioned it into elemental components, each of length delta L. The smaller delta L is, the more elemental elements we'll have. Potentially the more accurate our simulation will be, but also, of course, we'll have more work to do to simulate a system of a given size because we've just got more elements to simulate. And at each elemental component, this is a simple first-order system, then we have some sort of potential, which for a bucket might be the amount of water, the fill depth in it. For the heat conduction, it will be the temperature at that point in the rod. And for electrical conduction, it will be the voltage at that point on the rod. And then we have some inertia, which for water would be like the diameter of the bucket, or the area of the bucket. The larger that area, then the slower the height will change as we pump water in and out of it. For temperature, it would be the specific thermal capacity of that material. So if it's something with very high specific heat capacity, like copper, it's going to change much more slowly to temperature changes than if it was made of something very low heat capacity, like graphite. And same for electrical resistance. Different materials have different electrical conductivities. And then the other dimension that we have is the amount of connection between one elemental component and another. And so for water, it would be the size of the hole between adjacent buckets. If it was temperature, then it would be the thermal conductivity. And if it were electricity, then it would be the electrical resistance. And in all of these basic systems, we have the property of resistance, or we can also speak of its reciprocal, the conductance. And the amount of flow between one element and the next follows some sort of linear law, such as for sound waves in a rod, it's Hooke's law, the elastic deformation. For electrical conduction, it is Ohm's law, the current is proportional to the voltage difference. And also Newton's law of cooling is that the heat flow between two components is the difference in temperature divided by the thermal resistivity between them. So all of these systems have a number of real-world analogues, and the approach to simulating them all is going to be completely the same. But depending on your own upbringing, you might be more happier with the different physical realities. So now then, let's see if we can simulate this simple system. We're going to use a little bit of code which we can run, and the structure of this code is going to be that we have it's a one-dimensional system, and we only have one state variable for each elemental component, which is going to be its voltage or temperature or bucket fill length. And so the temperature or potential vector is an array of double precision components. Its length is the number of elements in our simulation. And in this particular code, we also need some additional vectors, which are here. But it's very important to understand which ones are state variables and which ones aren't. These are auxiliary ones. We can delete the contents of these ones each time we go around the simulation in the time step. So here's our main iteration. We're going to do some finite number of steps. In each time step, we're going to increment the system time by our elemental time, and then we're going to update all of the state elements in the current time step. And this is the first order update equations in here. And it'll turn out that we can discard this new temperature or potential at the end of the time step. We just copy it back into the main state vector. And the plotted y is just to help the graphical plotting of this in this particular program. It has nothing to do with the simulation, it's the output part. What we're going to do is we're going to update the temperature or potential in each elemental component. The new value is going to be the old value plus some effect from the neighbours. This is rho times delta T times dex. So rho is going to be the conductivity between the components. Delta T is our time step that we're advancing each time, and dex, which has gone off the right here, is this effect that we've calculated. This is the net flow in or out in this time step. And we're assuming that the end two components don't have a neighbour outside them, so we've got a couple of inequalities here. Well, actually, we're assuming this code, if you read it through very carefully, assumes that the external neighbours are tied to a constant zero, because we're going to substitute essentially the value zero for a neighbour off to the left and a neighbour off to the right. We'll come back to the maths in another slide, just fast forwarded. Let's see if we can just run that. So here is that code. So something's happening here. We have actually two things being plotted by this piece of code. One of them is a time domain plot for a given offset, and the other one is the value of all the potentials from the start to the end of the rod. And there was an initial impulse added in to that code. So this is what's on the slide. I have some specific values for delta T and rho. A little bit of plotting code. And then that one's commented out by the false there, disabled. That one's enabled. That's just writing in, if you read the code carefully, a triangular pulse of non-zero temperature into an offset 1/4 and of width. Goes out to 1/8 each side, and height 1/3 of the screen height for plotting. And there's that code that I've just shown you, and there's the plotting the pixels bit at the bottom. And finally, it copies the new values, new temperature, back into the old one. Let's just run that again so we can see it again. You might see the triangle shapes disappeared fairly quickly. The heat's spreading out. It's just a diffusion simulation. Each element is taking on some of its neighbours. Eventually, it averages out. There's a theory that we'll have ultimately the heat death of the universe, which is where everything in the whole universe is all the same temperature and the same colour and just one big blob. And that's basically what's happened here on a very small scale. And there's some sort of exponential decay which is apparent here. There's a flat bit at the top here because the bit I'm sampling off is outside the initial impulse, so we need some propagation delay before the impulse hits the point at which I'm measuring, and then it goes down. So that's a first order system. There's just one state variable for each position in the vector. Another simulation that we might consider, which looks pretty much the same, is if we now think of these as masses and springs, then the masses and springs type system tends to be a second order system, because each particular mass not only has its position, it also has its velocity. And in a time step, we need to, the position will change by the size of the time step times its velocity, and its velocity will change by the size of the time step times its force divided by its mass. That's Newton's law of motion, F equals ma, for those who've forgotten it. So the rate, the acceleration, will be the force divided by the mass. And we can implement that as well with a little bit of code. So changing this program slightly, it now looks like this, that we have two state variables for each component, position and the velocity. And the update equations are here, that in each time step, the position is incremented by the velocity times delta t at that point. So there's no crosstalk between elements, or no in the velocity and in that line, in the position update one, but the acceleration on the elements, which is this term here, is the change in velocity. So the velocity is going to be updated by, again, proportional to the time step, but also proportional to kk, which is, for a spring-type system, would be a reciprocal of Young's modulus, i.e. the elasticity of the interconnecting springs. And if they're very stiff, then this would be a high number, and if they're very, very flexible springs, then this would be a very low number. And so the amount that the offset of the neighbours plus and minus 1 has on the current component is proportional to that. And we can plot that one as well. This is rather grandly called violin string dot, because this is a simulation of a Stradivarius, but not very detailed simulation. There's no bow. It's got exactly the same. That's my wife. She knows I'm lecturing. Go away, wife. That we are adding an initial offset to the position of the string. The velocities are initialized to zero, and there's those equations and so on, and we can run that, see what happens, if it works. Yep, it's much more exciting simulation. It looks a bit like a real system, and I'm also, the time domain plot is a lot more interesting. We can see the fact that the initial impulse was some sort of triangular shape, and that's bounced around. There's also another term in here, which I didn't mention, which is a resistive loss. So in each time step, we're also just stealing a little bit of velocity. So it could be wind resistance or something else, soaking up some of the energy from the system. And so that value is making it decay away a little bit each time. And finally, this system is also, if you read the code, writing its output to a file. op1.wav, which is a Microsoft WAV file, so we can listen to that. We'll have to turn the volume up and we'll get the gain back maybe. Shall we exit the game, or shall we just play it? Let's just play it. So this is the sound that we've just simulated. There it goes. Started again. It's not a very interesting sound, but this technique can be generalized rather grandly. So have a look at those two programs. In general, of course, we're simulating much, much more complicated systems. Here's a lovely picture of part of an engine, and we can see that a grid has been superimposed on all the parts here, and the state vector for this would include, for each element, not just its temperature, but also perhaps its position and velocity in three dimensions, and also Well, that might be enough. Temperature and position and velocity in three dimensions.